balance doesn't exist. This is tough to conceive, much less believe, mainly because one of the most frequent laments is, I need more balance. It's a common mantra for what's missing in most lives. We hear about balance so much, we automatically assume it's exactly what we should be seeking. It's not. Purpose, meaning, significance. These are what make a successful life.
Seek balance and you will most certainly live your life out of balance,
crisscrossing an invisible middle line as you pursue your priorities. The act of living a full life by giving time to what matters is a balancing act. Extraordinary results require focused attention and time. Time on one thing means time away from another. This makes balance impossible.
The genesis of a myth.
Historically, balancing our lives is a novel privilege to even consider. For thousands of years, work was life. If you didn't work, hunt game, harvest crops, or raise livestock, you didn't live long. But things changed. Jared Diamond's Pulitzer Prize-winning book, Guns, Germs, and Steel, The Fate of Human Societies, illustrates how farm-based societies that generated a surplus of food ultimately gave rise to professional specialization. It says, 12,000 years ago, everybody on Earth was a hunter-gatherer. Now, almost all of us are farmers, or else are fed by farmers. This freedom from having to forage or farm allowed people to become scholars and craftsmen. Some worked to put food on our tables, while others built the tables. At first, most people worked according to their needs and ambitions. The blacksmith didn't have to stay at the forge until 5 p.m. He could go home when the horse's feet were shod. Then, 19th century industrialization saw, for the first time, large numbers working for someone else. The story became one of hard-driving bosses, year-round work schedules, and lighted factories that ignored dawn and dusk. Consequently, the 20th century witnessed the start of significant grassroots movements to protect workers and limit work hours. Still, the term work-life balance wasn't coined until the mid-1980s, when more than half of all married women joined the workforce. To paraphrase Ralph E. Gomery's preface in the 2005 book entitled Being Together, Working Apart, Dual Career Families and the Work-Life Balance, we went from a family unit with a breadwinner and a homemaker to one with two breadwinners and no homemaker. Anyone with a pulse knows who got stuck with the extra work in the beginning. However, by the 90s, work-life balance had quickly become a common watchword for men, too. A LexisNexis survey of the top 100 newspapers and magazines around the world shows a dramatic rise in the number of articles on the topic, from 32 in the decade from 1986 to 1996 to a high of 1,674 articles in 2007 alone. Figure 9 online at theonething.com shows the number of times the term work-life balance is mentioned in newspaper and magazine articles from 1986 through 2011. This online figure clearly illustrates how work-life balance has exploded as a topic in print media in recent years. It's probably not a coincidence that the ramp-up of technology parallels the rise in the belief that something is missing in our lives. Infiltrated space and fewer boundaries will do that. Rooted in real-life challenges, the idea of work-life balance has clearly captured our minds and imagination.
Middle mismanagement.
The desire for balance makes sense. Enough time for everything and everything done in time. It sounds so appealing that just thinking about it makes us feel serene and peaceful. This calm is so real that we just know it's the way life was meant to be. But it's not. If you think of balance as the middle, then out of balance is when you're away from it. Get too far away from the middle, and you're living at the extremes. The problem with living in the middle is that it prevents you from making extraordinary time commitments to anything. In your effort to attend to all things, everything gets shortchanged, and nothing gets its due. Sometimes this can be okay, and sometimes not. Knowing when to pursue the middle and when to pursue the extremes is, in essence, the true beginning of wisdom. Extraordinary results are achieved by this negotiation with your time. The reason we shouldn't pursue balance is that the magic never happens in the middle. Magic happens at the extremes. The dilemma is that chasing the extremes presents real challenges. We naturally understand that success lies at the outer edges, but we don't know how to manage our lives while we're out there. When we work too long, eventually our personal life suffers. Falling prey to the belief that long hours are virtuous, we unfairly blame work when we say, "I have no life." Often, it's just the opposite. Even if our work life doesn't interfere, our personal life itself can be so full of have-tos that we again reach the same defeated conclusion. I have no life. And sometimes, we get hit from both sides. Some of us face so many personal and professional demands that everything suffers. Breakdown imminent, we once again declare, "I have no life." Just like playing to the middle, playing to the extremes is the kind of middle mismanagement that plays out all the time.
Time waits for no one.
My wife once told me the story of a friend of hers. The friend's mother was a schoolteacher and her father was a farmer. They had scrimped, saved, and done with less their entire lives in anticipation of retirement and travel. The woman fondly remembered the regular shopping trips she and her mother would take to the local fabric store, where they would pick out some fabric and patterns. The mother explained that when she retired, these would be her travel clothes. She never got to her retirement years. In her final year of teaching, she developed cancer and later died. The father never felt good about spending the money they'd saved, believing that it was their money, and now she wasn't there to share it with him. When he passed away and my wife's friend went to clean out her parents' home, she discovered a closet full of fabric and dress patterns. The father had never cleaned it out. He couldn't. It represented too much. It was as if its contents were so full of unfulfilled promises that they were too heavy to lift. Time waits for no one. Push something to an extreme, and postponement can become permanent. I once knew a highly successful businessman who had worked long days and weekends for most of his life, sincere in his belief that he was doing it all for his family. Someday when he was done, they would all enjoy the fruits of his labor, spend time together, travel, and do all the things they'd never done. After giving many years to building his company, he had recently sold it and was open to discussing what he might do next. I asked him how he was doing, and he proudly proclaimed that he was fine. "When I was building the business, I was never home and rarely saw my family, so now I'm with them on vacation making up for lost time. You know how it is, right? Now that I have the money and the time, I'm getting those years back." Do you really think you can ever get back a child's bedtime story or birthday? Is a party for a 5-year-old with imaginary pals the same as dinner with a teenager with high school friends? Is an adult attending a young child's soccer game on par with attending a soccer game with an adult child? Do you think you can cut a deal with God that time stands still for you, holding off on anything important until you're ready to participate again? When you gamble with your time, you may be placing a bet you can't cover. Even if you're sure you can win, be careful that you can live with what you lose. Toying with time will lead you down a rabbit hole with no way out. Believing this lie does its harm by convincing you to do things you shouldn't and stop doing things you should. Middle mismanagement can be one of the most destructive things you ever do. You can't ignore the inevitability of time. So if achieving balance is a lie, then what do? You counterbalance. Replace the word balance with counterbalance, and what you experience makes sense. The things we presume to have balance are really just counterbalancing. The ballerina is a classic example. When the ballerina poses en pointe, she can appear weightless, floating on air, the very idea of balance and grace. A closer look would reveal her toe shoes vibrating rapidly, making minute adjustments for balance. Counterbalancing, done well, gives the illusion of balance.
Counterbalancing, the long and short of it.
When we say we're out of balance, we're usually referring to a sense that some priorities, things that matter to us, are being underserved or unmet. The problem is that when you focus on what is truly important, something will always be underserved. No matter how hard you try, there will always be things left undone at the end of your day, week, month, year, and life. Trying to get them all done is folly. When the things that matter most get done, you'll still be left with a sense of things being undone, a sense of imbalance. Leaving some things undone is a necessary trade-off for extraordinary results. But you can't leave everything undone, and that's where counterbalancing comes in. The idea of counterbalancing is that you never go so far that you can't find your way back, or stay so long that there is nothing waiting for you when you return. This is so important that your very life may hang in the balance. An 11-year study of nearly 7,100 British civil servants concluded that habitual long hours can be deadly. Researchers showed that individuals who worked more than 11 hours a day, that's a 55-plus hour work week, were 67% more likely to suffer from heart disease. Counterbalancing is not only about your sense of well-being. It's essential to your being well. There are two types of counterbalancing: the balancing between work and personal life, and the balancing within each. In the world of professional success, it's not about how much overtime you put in. The key ingredient is focused time over time. To achieve an extraordinary result, you must choose what matters most and give it all the time it demands. This requires getting extremely out of balance in relation to all other work issues, with only infrequent counterbalancing to address them. In your personal world, awareness is the essential ingredient. Awareness of your spirit and body, awareness of your family and friends, awareness of your personal needs. None of these can be sacrificed if you intend to have a life, so you can never forsake them for work or one for the other. You can move back and forth quickly between these, and often even combine the activities around them, but you can't neglect any of them for long. Your personal life requires tight counterbalancing. Whether or not to go out of balance isn't really the question. The question is, do you go short or long? In your personal life, go short and avoid long periods where you're out of balance. Going short lets you stay connected to all the things that matter most and move them along together. In your professional life, go long and make peace with the idea that the pursuit of extraordinary results may require you to be out of balance for long periods. Going long allows you to focus on what matters most, even at the expense of other lesser priorities. In your personal life, nothing gets left behind. At work, it's required. In his novel, Suzanne's Diary for Nicholas, James Patterson artfully highlights where our priorities lie in our personal and professional balancing act, when he writes the following. Imagine life is a game in which you are juggling five balls. The balls are called work, family, health, friends, and integrity. And you're keeping all of them in the air. But one day you finally come to understand that work is a rubber ball. If you drop it, it will bounce back. The other four balls, family, health, friends, integrity, are made of glass. If you drop one of these, it will be irrevocably scuffed, nicked, perhaps even shattered.
Life is a balancing act.
The question of balance is really a question of priority. When you change your language from balancing to prioritizing, you see your choices more clearly and open the door to changing your destiny. Extraordinary results demand that you set a priority and act on it. When you act on your priority, you'll automatically go out of balance, giving more time to one thing over another. The challenge, then, doesn't become one of not going out of balance, for in fact you must. The challenge becomes how long you stay on your priority. To be able to address your priorities outside of work, you must be clear about your most important work priority so you can get it done. Then go home and be clear about your priorities there so you can get back to work. When you're supposed to be working, work. And when you're supposed to be playing, play. It's a weird tightrope you're walking, but it's only when you get your priorities mixed up that things fall apart.
Big ideas. Think about two balancing buckets. Separate your work life and personal life into two distinct buckets, not to compartmentalize them, just for counterbalancing. Each has its own counterbalancing goals and approaches. Counterbalance your work bucket. View work as involving a skill or knowledge that must be mastered. This will cause you to give disproportionate time to your one thing and will throw the rest of your work day, week, month, and year continually out of balance. Your work life is divided into two distinct areas. What matters most and everything else. You will have to take what matters to the extremes and be okay with what happens to the rest. Professional success requires it. Counterbalance your personal life bucket. Acknowledge that your life actually has multiple areas and that each requires a minimum of attention for you to feel that you have a life. Drop any one and you will feel the effects. This requires constant awareness. You must never go too long or too far without counterbalancing them so that they are all active areas of your life. Your personal life requires it.
Start leading a counterbalanced life. Let the right things take precedence when they should, and get to the rest when you can. An extraordinary life is a counterbalancing act.
Chapter 9. Big is bad. Robert Brault said, "We are kept from our goal, not by obstacles, but by a clear path to a lesser goal."
The Big Bad Wolf, Big Bad John. From folk tales to folk songs, the suggestion that big and bad go together has been a common theme across history, so much so that many think they're synonymous. They're not. Big can be bad, and bad can be big, but they're not one and the same. They aren't inherently related. A big opportunity is better than a small one, but a small problem is better than a big one. Sometimes you want the biggest present under the tree, and sometimes you want the smallest. Often a big laugh or a big cry is just what you need, and every so often a small chuckle and a few tears will do the trick. Big and bad are no more tied together than small and good. Big is bad is a lie. It's quite possibly the worst lie of all, for if you fear big success, you'll either avoid it or sabotage your efforts to achieve it.
Who's afraid of the big bad big?
Place big and results in the same room and a lot of people balk or walk. Mention big with achievement and their first thoughts are hard, complicated, and time-consuming, difficult to get there, and complex once you do, pretty much sums up their views. Overwhelming and intimidating is what they feel. For some reason, there is the fear that big success brings crushing pressure and stress, that the pursuit of it robs them of not only time with family and friends, but eventually their health. Uncertain of the right to achieve big, or fearful of what might happen if they try and fall short, their head spins just thinking about it, and they immediately doubt they have a head for heights. All of this reinforces a dis-ease with the very idea of big. To invent a word, call it megaphobia. That's the irrational fear of big. When we connect big with bad, we trigger shrinking thinking. Lowering our trajectory feels safe. Staying where we are feels prudent. But the opposite is true. When big is believed to be bad, small thinking rules the day, and big never sees the light of it.
Flat wrong.
How many ships didn't sail because of the belief that the earth was flat? How much progress was impeded because man wasn't supposed to breathe underwater, fly through the air, or venture into outer space? Historically, we've done a remarkably poor job of estimating our limits. The good news is that science isn't about guessing, but rather the art of progressing. And so is your life. None of us knows our limits. Borders and boundaries may be clear on a map, but when we apply them to our lives, the lines aren't so apparent. I was once asked if I thought thinking big was realistic. I paused to reflect on this and then said, "Let me ask you a question first. Do you know what your limits are?" They replied, "No." So I said that it seemed the question was irrelevant. No one knows their ultimate ceiling for achievement, so worrying about it was a waste of time. What if someone told you that you could never achieve above a certain level, that you were required to pick an upper limit which you could never exceed? What would you pick, a low one or a high one? I think we know the answer. Put in this situation, we would all do the same thing. We would go big. Why? Because you wouldn't want to limit yourself. When you allow yourself to accept that big is about who you can become, you look at it differently. In this context, big is a placeholder for what you might call a leap of possibility. It's the office intern visualizing the boardroom, or a penniless immigrant imagining a business revolution. It's about bold ideas that might threaten your comfort zones, but simultaneously reflect your greatest opportunities. Believing in big frees you to ask different questions, follow different paths, and try new things. This opens the doors to possibilities that until now only lived inside you. Sabir Bhatia arrived in America with only $250 in his pocket, but he wasn't alone. Sabir came with big plans and the belief that he could grow a business faster than any business in history. And he did. He created Hotmail. Microsoft, a witness to Hotmail's meteoric rise, eventually bought it for $400 million. According to his mentor, Farooq Arjuni, Sabir's success was directly related to his ability to think big. Arjuni says, "What sets Sabir apart from hundreds of entrepreneurs I've met is the gargantuan size of his dream. Even before he had a product, before he had money behind him, he was completely convinced that he was going to build a major company that would be worth hundreds of millions of dollars. He had an unrelenting conviction that he was not just going to build a run-of-the-mill Silicon Valley company. But over time, I realized, by golly, he was probably going to pull it off. As of 2011, Hotmail ranked as one of the most successful webmail service providers in the world, with more than 360 million active users.
Going big.
Thinking big is essential to extraordinary results. Success requires action, and action requires thought. But here's the catch. The only actions that become springboards to succeeding big are those informed by big thinking to begin with. Make this connection, and the importance of how big you think begins to sink in. Everyone has the same amount of time, and hard work is simply hard work. As a result, what you do in the time you work determines what you achieve. And since what you do is determined by what you think, how big you think becomes the launching pad for how high you achieve. Think of it this way. Every level of achievement requires its own combination of what you do, how you do it, and who you do it with. The trouble is that the combination of what, how, and who that gets you to one level of success won't naturally evolve to a better combination that leads to the next level of success. Doing something one way doesn't always lay the foundation for doing something better, nor does a relationship with one person automatically set the stage for a more successful relationship with another. It's unfortunate, but these things don't build on each other. If you learn to do something one way and with one set of relationships, that may work fine until you want to achieve more. It's then that you'll discover you've created an artificial ceiling of achievement for yourself that may be too hard to break through. In effect, you've boxed yourself in when there is a simple way to avoid it. Think as big as you possibly can and base what you do, how you do it, and who you do it with on succeeding at that level. It just might take you more than your lifetime to run into the walls of a box this big. When people talk about reinventing their career or their business, small boxes are often the root cause. What you build today will either empower or restrict you tomorrow. It will either serve as a platform for the next level of your success or as a box trapping you where you are.
Thomas Henry Huxley said, "The rung of a ladder was never meant to rest upon, but only to hold a man's foot long enough to enable him to put the other somewhat higher."
Big gives you the best chance for extraordinary results today and tomorrow. When Arthur Guinness set up his first brewery, he signed a 9,000-year lease. When J.K. Rowling conceived Harry Potter, she thought big and envisioned 7 years at Hogwarts before she penned the first chapter of the first 7 books. Before Sam Walton opened the first Walmart, he envisioned a business so big that he felt he needed to go ahead and set up his future estate plan to minimize inheritance taxes. By thinking big, long before he made it big, he was able to save his family an estimated $11 to $13 billion in estate taxes. Transferring the wealth of one of the greatest companies ever built as tax-free as possible requires thinking big from the beginning. Thinking big isn't just about business. Candace Leitner started Mothers Against Drunk Driving in 1980 after her daughter was killed in a hit-and-run accident by a drunk driver. Today, MAD has saved more than 300,000 lives. As a 6-year-old in 1998, Ryan Reljak was inspired by stories told by his teacher to help bring clean water to Africa. Today his foundation, Ryan's Well, has improved conditions and helped bring safe water to over 750,000 people in 16 countries. Derek Kayongo recognized both the waste and hidden value in getting new soap into hotels every day. So in 2009, he created the Global Soap Project, which has provided more than 250,000 bars of soap in 21 countries, helping combat child mortality by simply giving impoverished people the chance to wash their hands. Asking big questions can be daunting. Big goals can seem unattainable at first. Yet how many times have you set out to do something that seemed like a real stretch at the time, only to discover it was much easier than you thought? Sometimes things are easier than we imagine, and truthfully, sometimes they're a lot harder. That's when it's important to realize that on the journey to achieving big, you get bigger. Big requires growth, and by the time you arrive, you're big, too. What seemed an insurmountable mountain from a distance is just a small hill when you arrive, at least in proportion to the person you've become. Your thinking, your skills, your relationships, your sense of what is possible and what it takes all grow on the journey to big. As you experience big, you become big.
The Big Deal.
For more than 4 decades, Stanford psychologist Carol S. Dweck has studied the science of how our self-conceptions influence our actions. Her work offers great insight into why thinking big is such a big deal. Dweck's work with children revealed 2 mindsets in action: a growth mindset that generally thinks big and seeks growth, and a fixed mindset that places artificial limits and avoids failure. Growth-minded students, as she calls them, employ better learning strategies, experience less helplessness, exhibit more positive effort, and achieve more in the classroom than their fixed-minded peers. They are less likely to place limits on their lives and more likely to reach for their potential. Dweck points out that mindsets can and do change. Like any other habit, you set your mind to it until the right mindset becomes routine. When Scott Forstall started recruiting talent to his newly formed team, he warned that the top secret project would provide ample opportunities to make mistakes and struggle. But, he said, eventually we may do something that we'll remember the rest of our lives. He gave this curious pitch to superstars across the company, but only took those who immediately jumped at the challenge. He was looking for growth-minded people, as he later shared with Dweck after reading her book. Why is this significant? While you've probably never even heard of Forrestal, you've certainly heard of what his team created. Forrestal was a senior vice president at Apple, and the team he formed created the iPhone.
Blowing up your life.
Big stands for greatness, meaning extraordinary results. Pursue a big life, and you're pursuing the greatest life you can possibly live. To live great, you have to think big. You must be open to the possibility that your life and what you accomplish can become great. Achievement and abundance show up because they're the natural outcomes of doing the right things with no limits attached. Don't fear big. Fear mediocrity. Fear waste. Fear the lack of living to your fullest. When we fear big, we either consciously or subconsciously work against it. We either run toward lesser outcomes and opportunities, or we simply run away from the big ones. If courage isn't the absence of fear, but moving past it, then thinking big isn't the absence of doubts, but moving past them. Only living big will let you experience your true life and work potential.
Big ideas. Think big. Avoid incremental thinking that simply asks, "What do I do next?" This is, at best, the slow lane to success, and at worst, the off-ramp. Ask bigger questions. A good rule of thumb is to double down everywhere in your life. If your goal is 10, ask the question, "How can I reach 20?" Set a goal so far above what you want that you'll be building a plan that practically guarantees your original goal. Don't order from the menu. Apple's celebrated 1997 Think Different ad campaign features icons like Ali, Dylan, Einstein, Hitchcock, Picasso, Gandhi, and others who saw things differently and who went on to transform the world we know. The point was that they didn't choose from the available options. They imagined outcomes that no one else had. They ignored the menu and ordered their own creations. As the ad reminds us, people who are crazy enough to think they can change the world are the only ones who do. Act bold. Big thoughts go nowhere without bold action. Once you've asked a big question, pause to imagine what life looks like with the answer. If you still can't imagine it, go study people who have already achieved it. What are the models, systems, habits, and relationships of other people who have found the answer? As much as we'd like to believe we're all different, what consistently works for others will almost always work for us. Don't fear failure. It's as much a part of your journey to extraordinary results as success. Adopt a growth mindset, and don't be afraid of where it can take you. Extraordinary results aren't built solely on extraordinary results. They're built on failure, too. In fact, it would be accurate to say that we fail our way to success. When we fail, we stop. We ask what we need to do to succeed. We learn from our mistakes, and we grow. Don't be afraid to fail. See it as part of your learning process and keep striving for your true potential.
Don't let small thinking cut your life down to size. Think big, aim high, act bold, and see just how big you can blow up your life.
Part 2. The Truth, the Simple Path to Productivity. Eric Heller said, "Be careful how you interpret the world. It is like that." Unclenched.
For many years, I suffered from trying to live the lies of success. I began my career assuming everything mattered equally, so in an effort to cram it all in, I attempted too much at once. Frustrated, I eventually began to doubt I had the discipline or will to achieve success at all. As my life continually fell out of balance, I started to consider that trying to live a big life might be a bad thing. When you try to live up to something that isn't possible, you can get pretty down. I was pretty down. In an attempt to make it all work, I began to bear down even harder. You might say that I started to clench my way to success. I really did. I thought that this might be the way you went through life, with your jaw clenched, your fist clenched, your stomach clenched, and your butt clenched. Leaning forward, breath held and body taut, tight and totally tense. I just assumed that was the feeling of focus and intensity as I struggled to live with the lies. That approach actually worked, but it also put me in the hospital. I also began to think you had to talk like a success, walk like a success, and even dress for success. It wasn't me, but I was open to any way to make things work. So I took seriously the suggestion that you are supposed to project the way you want to be. That approach worked as well, but after a while, I simply got tired of playing success. I bought into getting up before the crack of dawn, getting revved up playing inspirational theme songs, and getting going before anyone else. In fact, I became so full of this thinking that I would drive to the office while the rest of the city slept, and then crash at my desk just to make sure that I beat everyone else to work. I started to accept the notion that maybe this is what ambition and achievement looked like as I fought the good fight. I would hold staff meetings at 7:30 in the morning, and at 7:31, I would actually shut the door and lock out anyone who showed up late. I was going overboard, but I was beginning to believe this was the only way you could succeed, and the way you pushed others to succeed as well. This approach also worked. But in the end, it also pushed me too hard, others too far, and my world over the edge. I was truly beginning to think that the secret to success was to get as tightly wound up as possible each morning, set myself on fire, and then open the door and fly through the day unwinding on the world until I literally burnt out. And what did all of this get me? It got me success, and it got me sick. Eventually, it got me sick of success. So what did I do? I ditched the lies and went in the opposite direction. I joined Overachievers Anonymous and went anti-establishment on all the success tactics that supposedly build success. First off, I got unclenched. I actually started listening to my body, slowed down, and chilled out. Next, I started wearing T-shirts and jeans to work and defied anyone to make a comment. I dropped the language and the attitude and went back to just being me. I had breakfast with my family. I got in shape physically and spiritually and stayed there. And last, I started doing less. Yes, less. Intentionally. Purposefully less. I was looser than ever, way laid back for me, and breathing. I challenged the axioms of success, and guess what? I became more successful than I ever dreamed possible, and felt better than I'd ever felt in my life. Here's what I found out. We overthink, overplan, and overanalyze our careers, our businesses, and our lives. I learned that long hours are neither virtuous nor healthy, and that we usually succeed in spite of most of what we do, not because of it. I discovered that we can't manage time, and that the key to success isn't in all the things we do, but in the handful of things we do well. I learned that success comes down to this, being appropriate in the moments of your life. If you can honestly say, this is where I'm meant to be right now, doing exactly what I'm doing, then all the amazing possibilities for your life become possible. Most of all, I learned that the one thing is the surprisingly simple truth behind extraordinary results.
Chapter 10, The Focusing Question. George Anders said, "There is an art to clearing away the clutter and focusing on what matters most. It is simple and it is transferable. It just requires the courage to take a different approach."
On June 23, 1885, in the town of Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, Andrew Carnegie addressed the students of the Curry Commercial College. At the height of his business success, the Carnegie Steel Company was the largest and most profitable industrial enterprise in the world.
Carnegie would later become the second richest man in history after John D. Rockefeller. In Carnegie's talk, entitled The Road to Business Success, he discussed his life as a successful business person and gave this advice. And here is the prime condition of success, the great secret. Concentrate your energy, thought, and capital exclusively upon the business in which you are engaged. Having begun on one line, resolve to fight it out on that line, to lead in it. Adopt every improvement, have the best machinery, and know the most about it. The concerns which fail are those which have scattered their capital, which means that they have scattered their brains also. They have investments in this, or that, or the other, here, there, and everywhere. Don't put all your eggs in one basket is all wrong. I tell you, put all your eggs in one basket and then watch that basket. Look round you and take notice. Men who do that do not often fail. It is easy to watch and carry the one basket. It's trying to carry too many baskets that breaks most eggs in this country. So how do you know which basket to pick? The answer is the focusing question. Mark Twain agreed with Carnegie and described it this way. The secret of getting ahead is getting started. The secret to getting started is breaking your complex, overwhelming tasks into small, manageable tasks, and then starting on the first one. So how do you know what the first one should be? Again, it's the focusing question. Did you notice that both of these great men considered their advice a secret? I don't think it's so much a secret as something people know but don't give proper weight or importance. Most people are familiar with the Chinese proverb, a journey of 1,000 miles must begin with a single step. They just never stop to fully appreciate that if this is true, then the wrong first step begins a journey that could end as far as 2,000 miles from where they want to be. The focusing question helps keep your first step from being a misstep.
Life is a question.
You may be asking, why focus on a question when what we really crave is an answer? It's simple. Answers come from questions, and the quality of any answer is directly determined by the quality of the question. Ask the wrong question, get the wrong answer. Ask the right question, get the right answer. Ask the most powerful question possible, and the answer can be life-altering. Voltaire once wrote, "Judge a man by his questions rather than his answers." Sir Francis Bacon added, "A prudent question is one half of wisdom." Indira Gandhi concluded that the power to question is the basis of all human progress. Great questions are clearly the quickest path to great answers. Every discoverer and inventor begins his quest with a transformative question. The scientific method asks questions of the universe in hypothesis form. The more than 2,000-year-old Socratic method, teaching through questions, is still embraced by educators from the heights of Harvard Law School to the local kindergarten class. Questions engage our critical thinking. Research shows that asking questions improves learning and performance by as much as 150%. In the end, it's hard to argue with author Nancy Willard, who wrote, "Sometimes questions are more important than answers." I first became aware of the power of questions as a young man. I read a poem that affected me profoundly, and I've carried it with me ever since. Listen for yourself.
My Wage by J.B. Rittenhouse.
I bargained with life for a penny, and life would pay no more. However I begged at evening when I counted my scanty store. For life is a just employer. He gives you what you ask. But once you have set the wages, why, you must bear the task. I worked for a menial's hire, only to learn, dismayed, that any wage I had asked of life, life would have willingly paid. The last two lines deserve repeating. Any wage I had asked of life, life would have willingly paid. One of the most empowering moments of my life came when I realized that life is a question, and how we live it is our answer. How we phrase the questions we ask ourselves
determines the answers that eventually become our life. The challenge is that the right question isn't always so obvious. Most things we want don't come with a roadmap or a set of instructions, so it can be difficult to frame the right question. Clarity must come from us. It seems we must envision our own journeys, make our own maps, and create our own compasses. To get the answers we seek, we have to invent the right questions, and we're left to devise our own. So how do you do this? How do you come up with uncommon questions that take you to uncommon answers? You ask one question, the focusing question. Anyone who dreams of an uncommon life eventually discovers there is no choice but to seek an uncommon approach to living it. The focusing question is that uncommon approach. In a world of no instructions, it becomes the simple formula for finding exceptional answers that lead to extraordinary results. The focusing question asks the following: what's the one thing I can do such that by doing it, everything else will be easier or unnecessary? The focusing question is so deceptively simple that its power is easily dismissed by anyone who doesn't closely examine it. But that would be a mistake. The focusing question can lead you to answer not only big picture questions such as where am I going or what target should I aim for, but also small focus ones as well, like what must I do right now to be on the path to getting the big picture? Or where's the bullseye? It tells you not only what your basket should be, but also the first step toward getting it. It shows you how big your life can be and just how small you must go to get there. It's both a map for the big picture and a compass for your smallest next move. Extraordinary results are rarely happenstance. They come from the choices we make and the actions we take. The focusing question always aims you at the absolute best of both by forcing you to do what is essential to success: make a decision. But not just any decision. It drives you to make the best decision. It ignores what is doable and drills down to what is necessary, to what matters. It leads you to the first domino. To stay on track for the best possible day, month, year, or career, you must keep asking the focusing question. Ask it again and again, and it forces you to line up tasks in their levered order of importance. Then, each time you ask it, you see your next priority. The power of this approach is that you're setting yourself up to accomplish one task on top of another. When you do the right task first, you also build the right mindset first, the right skill first, and the right relationship first. Powered by the focusing question, your actions become a natural progression of building one right thing on top of the previous right thing. When this happens, you're in position to experience the power of the domino effect.
Anatomy of the question.
The focusing question collapses all possible questions into one. What's the one thing I can do such that by doing it, everything else will be easier or unnecessary?
Part 1. What's the one thing I can do?
This sparks focused action. The phrase, what's the one thing, tells you the answer will be one thing versus many. It forces you towards something specific. It tells you right up front that, although you may consider many options, you need to take this seriously because you don't get 2, 3, 4, or more. You can't hedge your bet. You're allowed to pick one thing and one thing only. The last phrase, can do, is an embedded command directing you to take action that is possible. People often want to change this to should do, could do, or would do. But those choices all miss the point. There are many things we should, could, or would do, but never do. Action you can do beats intention every time.
Shel Silverstein said, "But those woulda, coulda, shouldas all ran away and hid from one little did." Part 2. Such that by doing it.
This portion of the focusing question tells you there is a criterion your answer must meet. It's the bridge between just doing something and doing something for a specific purpose, such that by doing it lets you know you're going to have to dig deep, because when you do this one thing, something else is going to happen.
Part 3. Everything else will be easier or unnecessary.
Archimedes said, "Give me a lever long enough and I could move the world." And that's exactly what this last part tells you to find. Everything else will be easier or unnecessary is the ultimate leverage test. It tells you when you found the first domino. It says that when you do this one thing, everything else you do to accomplish your goal will now either be doable with less effort or no longer even necessary. Most people struggle to comprehend how many things don't need to be done if they would just start by doing the right thing. In effect, this qualifier seeks to declutter your life by asking you to put on blinders. This elevates the answer's potential to change your life by doing the leveraged thing and avoiding distractions. The focusing question asks you to find the first domino and focus on it exclusively until you knock it over. Once you've done that, you'll discover a line of dominoes behind it either ready to fall or already downed.
Big ideas. Great questions are the path to great answers. The focusing question is a great question designed to find a great answer. It will help you find the first domino for your job, your business, or any other area in which you want to achieve extraordinary results. The focusing question is a double-duty question. It comes in two forms, big picture and small focus. One is about finding the right direction in life, and the other is about finding the right action. The big picture question asks, "What's my one thing?" Use it to develop a vision for your life and the direction for your career or company. It is your strategic compass. It also works when considering what you want to master, what you want to give to others and your community, and how you want to be remembered. It keeps your relationships with friends, family, and colleagues in perspective and your daily actions on track. The small focus question asks, "What's my one thing right now?" Use this when you first wake up and throughout the day. It keeps you focused on your most important work and, whenever you need it, helps you find the levered action or first domino in any activity. The small focus question prepares you for the most productive work week possible. It's effective in your personal life, too, keeping you attentive to your most important immediate needs, as well as those of the most important people in your life.
Extraordinary results come from asking the focusing question. It's how you plot your course through life and business, and how you'll make the best progress on your most important work. Whether you seek answers big or small, asking the focusing question is the ultimate success habit for your life.
Chapter 11, The Success Habit. Arnold H. Glaso said, "Success is simple. Do what's right, the right way, at the right time."
You know about habits. They can be hard to break and hard to create. But we are unknowingly acquiring new ones all the time. When we start and continue a way of thinking or a way of acting over a long enough period, we've created a new habit. The choice we face is whether or not we want to form habits that get us what we want from life. If we do, then the focusing question is the most powerful success habit we can have. For me, the focusing question is a way of life. I use it to find my most leveraged priority, make the most out of my time, and get the biggest bang for my buck. Whenever the outcome absolutely matters, I ask it. I ask it when I wake up and start my day. I ask it when I get to work, and again when I get home. What's the one thing I can do such that by doing it, everything else will be easier or unnecessary? And when I know the answer, I continue to ask it until I can see the connections and all my dominoes are lined up. Obviously, you can drive yourself nuts analyzing every little aspect of everything you might do. I don't do that, and you shouldn't either. Start with the big stuff and see where it takes you.
Over time, you'll develop your own sense of when to use